by the way, remember. It's not by way of rationalising or excusing the sort of studies we're doing, but I see so much in so many churches today where even pastors and other leaders don't really understand these things that are biblically based, and so they go about with what they think in all good faith and hope is a quick shortcut method of helping people. Now, one of the things that P.T. Forsyth said is that nothing will satisfy the conscience of man which does not first satisfy the conscience of God. Now, you think that through. Nothing will satisfy the conscience of man which does not first satisfy the conscience of God. It makes sense, doesn't it? The law is the outshining of God's nature. He demands nothing less than true and full obedience. The conscience demands that. But when we have sinned and this whole mess is there contained within us, something has to happen to touch that or to treat and deal with that that sets us free from it. It's intolerable that we should go around with one thing on our consciences. Absolutely intolerable. And today I see, and pastors are saying to us, different churches are saying, we have diverged from where we were 15 to 20 years ago. We've got another kind of gospel altogether. It's a sort of happy gospel, a semi-entertainment gospel. Do you know what I mean? Something that gives you a bit of a stimulus. And I say that because, not being critical of these men, because some of them now are coming and saying, will you tell us how to go back or to come back or to where we were, or take us on from where we never were? And so I just pass that on to you. So just letting the old cogs move occasionally in studies like this won't harm anybody. You can have all your hijinks and that if you want to. Go where you like for those. But I think that ultimately your understanding of this is what stands you in good stead. And you're no longer tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine. You come into maturity. Now that's not just a self-praise or anything, but that's what we're about here. All right, point F on page 17. Finally, we see that conscience has a predictive element, especially in regard to law. Now, the word predictive is not quite a good word. I think if I write this again, I'd say a forward-looking or a forward-sensing element is in conscience. What do we mean by that? And I didn't quote Forsyth fully here. He says, conscience makes man man, makes him one, and makes him eternal. Conscience makes man man, makes him one, makes him eternal. And he said, that which goes deepest to the conscience goes widest to the world. I think I shared a little personal thing with your last study that when I was talking to somebody one day, he said, well, your ministry has power because you speak to the conscience and not at it. But I tell you, I can remember when I used to speak at the conscience. And boy, is that powerful. And is that destructive. You speak at a person's conscience, you'll produce senses of guilt and even of remorse. But if you speak to a conscience, when God speaks to the conscience, that's an act of love to liberate us from the bondage of our sin. And so, conscience makes man man. Animals don't have a conscience. Makes us one. That is the one factor. I've spoken in, sound of using the word I this morning, but it's not deliberate. Spoken in many, many countries to many, many different cultures and peoples. And I know one thing, that the thing which is common to them all, to us all, and right throughout the world, is the conscience. I remember once I was in Mexico and I was speaking through a translator who didn't really know what I was saying. He mightn't have been the only one, mightn't have been his fault, but you know, he couldn't translate it. And I said, look, I think we mustn't burden you because I'm not getting through. I said, I think. They said, oh, you're getting through all right. They said, you just go on talking. They said that it was coming through whether the translator could translate it or not. And that's a very strange thing. All right, and it makes him eternal. Now, that's the point we want to get hold of. In Ecclesiastes 3:11, it says, you have made everything appropriate in its own time, and you have put eternity into man's heart, so that by searching he cannot find out the end from the beginning. In other words, God has put an eternal dimension into us. That's why we can't ultimately be satisfied just with white goods and soft goods and whatever. You know what I'm saying? We thought we could, but they really don't touch us, except as something that may be useful along the way. All right, so it must mean that man knows his actions are not significant simply and only for this time, but relate to that which is beyond time. Now, I think I might have mentioned that when in the book by Gordon on Miracle at the River Kwai, he points out that what the Japanese tried to do was to destroy the memory of the prisoners. Because once you destroy your memory, you become a zombie. And you're not a human being anymore. And I've often said to people, it's better to be able to remember your sin than not to be able to remember anything. You've still got some semblance of, you know, humanity about you. Now, we have a sense of that we're always looking forward. There's no question about that. We're always looking forward, and we always know that what we have done somehow or another relates to what we will be. True? And I think that's very important to keep that in mind. He has a sense of the eternal, and so a sense of the worth or worthlessness of his actions in the light of eternity. I must be honest and say that over the past few weeks I've been in a situation that I haven't been in for 40 years, personally. I'm a bit burned out. But I remember going back to that 40 years ago, or a little bit longer than 40 years ago, and I can remember the thing that obsessed me was that my life was not to be stupid and useless. And so I guess I've always wanted to see the time there and to use it. And I think that there's a way in which you can use it which you think is using it, which is not always the way God wants you to have to use it. But it's still about the same thing. It's just the mode of it that sometimes is our trouble. So the directive and predictive elements then must be related. In other words, if you see where you're going and you see that what you're doing now is linked up with what you'll be then, and if you can sense the directive element of your conscience, you can be the most joyful and enriched person in all the world. See, Job could say, well, whatever comes to me on this dunghill with this disease, I know I've obeyed him from the heart, and that he has accepted me. Big thing to be able to say, isn't it? Paul could say, I've fought a good fight, I've kept the faith, henceforth is laid up for me a crown of righteousness. What a fantastic thing. And what a drivelling, miserable thing to use your life entertaining yourself. As he's deeply down, that's part of what the conscience knows. That's why it's urging us on to do that which is obedience and to spurn that which is not. One is directed with a view to the significant outcome of the predicted result. If in fact there were no outcome from our moral or immoral actions, then there would be nothing for man to be concerned about. Conscience then is directing man to consider the future and outcome of his wrong or right decisions. That's with us all the time. I can remember having a period of about 18 months of incredible, loneliness out in the limbo, because my faith was tested in a prison camp. And at the end of it, I wrote that song, Angel Wings Beating My Face, because I knew God had directed things in the ultimate. You never are alone, you know what I mean, one way or the other. And but why am I saying that? Because the thought came to my mind during those 18 months, if that law is not from God, and if God doesn't exist, then there is nothing that is evil, and there is nothing that is good. Now, we're so trained to think there's something is good or something is evil, that even if we're not Christians, we still talk about good and evil. Do you follow? But if that law is created, is invented by man, then rape is no worse than anything else, than having a cup of tea, and so on. So it's very, very important that we know these things. Right, the state of man under law and conscience. Well, we've really, in some ways, we've dealt with it, but we'll go through it quite quickly. The story told in Genesis chapter 3 is that man believed his eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil would liberate him to become independent of God and able of himself to know good and evil. In fact, that act brought him into bondage of evil. It altered his relationship with God, the creation, and his fellow beings. And unable to face the basic truth of things as they essentially are, man is thus unable to accept the true law of God. So we said, ontologically, the way things really are, the law is fits that, like a glove. So if you change the nature of God, you must change the nature of man. If you change the nature of man, you must change the nature of God. And you must change what you call your worldview. See, every one of us lives according to his or her worldview. Now, we were just having a discussion, some of us different discussion during the time, does God love everyone equally? Well, I don't want to go into the subject, but I would say God loves everyone wholly. There's no kind of equal thing, you know what I mean? There's no, it's not a quantitative thing, it's a qualitative thing. God loves everyone, totally. And that's why hell will be hell for the sinner, because God loves him. I even have a theory in my mind which I'm not pressing, and that is that since God is a consuming fire, and since hell's a consuming fire, then eternity, the hell of eternity, will be man having to live in the love of God whilst his heart is utterly impenitent. However, that's just by the way. Not by the way, probably is how it is. So you see, man said, I can know truth of myself, I can know what is good and what is evil in myself. He's really saying, I don't need my conscience. Or my conscience just the faculty that God's put there by creation, and so I handle it. And you go and do that. If the law is not of God, well, it doesn't really matter. But if it is, then, boy, we are really in the soup, aren't we? So he has to oppose his conscience on the basic truth when it adjudicates along such lines. If you won't accept God as he is, then you're going to be constantly confronted by God as he is, and the world as it is, and humanity as it is, and so you've got to spend all your days trying to rationalize it or re-rationalize it. That's a pretty heavy trip. Since the way of a man is not in himself, that's what Jeremiah said, man has to devise a rationale of God, creation, and man has to revise what he, the way things are as to the way he thinks they must be. His new rationale cannot be acceptable to the conscience, which essentially relates to the truth of thing, and a man then is in double conflict. What proves to be distressing to him is the essential nature of things which he has opposed. And man has to live with a consciousness of evil, that is an evil conscience. When he seeks to suppress his conscience, he does damage to himself. And Romans 1:18 says that God's wrath is upon those who suppress the truth by acts of unrighteousness. In fact, they can't just sit back and be neutral. You've got to be in the damaging operation. And the more you damage what is God and man and the world, the more you damage yourself, because you're more and more perverse. Do you see that? And you're tricked into more and more perversity. And as we saw before, the wrath is primarily felt and experienced in the conscience, and this more so because God personally opposes man in his sin. Should a man seek to justify himself by obedience to law, then he comes under the curse of law. Paul said, do you not know, those of you who wish to be under the law, that if you come under the law, you're under the curse of the law? See, we talked before that the law is a very, very beautiful thing. But if you are using law in order to justify yourself, it becomes a horrible thing. Can you see that? And it keeps on eating away at you. He will then know innate rebellion and disobedience on the one hand, and seek to pacify his conscience by law observance on the other hand. In other words, he's a rebel trying to go on being rebellious. Remember some years ago we had a group of people called the Jesus people? Well, I used to minister amongst them. You remember them very well, some of you. And they were what I call a bunch of Christian swingers. They wanted to do everything that the worldling does and still have the comfort of salvation. Now, can you see their conflict? I'd rather be a straight-out sinner and go it strong than be in that messy situation, because they know, conscience-wise, what the truth is and what action is, and they seek to rationalise it all the time. One of the favourite ones was to say that Jesus was a revolutionary. Well, boy, what a racket. Right, further to this, his sins are ineradicable, so that he is beset about by fear of judgment and punishment, and in fact knows something of these elements from the action that takes place within his own conscience. You see that? It's turning over all the time. This action we've seen is condemnatory and punitive. So man certainly is in a humanly insoluble predicament. Conscience and authority. We've observed that in the case of the primal couple, that's Adam and Eve, conscience came into operation as a consciousness of evil rather than the undisturbed serenity of innocence. Can you hear that one? That when they were innocent, they knew good and evil in a way they could never know it once they became guilty. Innocence is far different to... innocence is not ignorance. Innocence may well be the purest knowledge we can have. It has sometimes been pointed out that the clear, limpid lake before the throne of God, you know, the sea of glass before the throne of God? That's incredible. You can look at that picture later on in Revelation 4. You can look right down into it. It's limpid. You can look right down into it and you'll find nothing there. Nothing of any... See, the wicked are like the restless sea that casts up mire and dirt. There is no peace, says my Lord, to the wicked. They cast up mire and dirt. So all the filth of the past is just churned up in the processes of life. And so to have an innocent conscience must be an incredible thing. Now, not one of us here has an innocent conscience. But we have consciences that are as innocent. Think that over. Right, conscience authority, right. So, nevertheless, man's sense of his own evil is not primarily at his individual acts of sin so much as his total approach to God. Now, it is common to the entire human race to feel inferior. There is nobody excepted. You'll find some pretty extroverted, tough people, you know, who seem to be superior. But it's compulsive with them to be superior so that they don't have to face the fact that they're inferior. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God means the end of tranquility. Means we are all dissatisfied with ourselves. If I went round one by one this morning and asked you, you'd all tell me, well, yeah. I do feel inferior. That's one of my problems, I feel inferior. Well, just at least have the satisfaction come from knowing that everybody here in this room is the same. And some of us have been working hard for years to get rid of the inferiority thing. Now, we only feel inferior because we have fallen from what we were. We've sinned and come short of the glory of God. If you come short of the glory of God, you come short of the glory of man. For what you really are. And so we're all that way. All I'm saying is, but there are two forms of guilt. There's guilt for the things we have done that are wrong or have not done that are right. We all know that guilt, don't we? It's a present, immediate guilt. And there's what is called existential guilt. That is, we know we are not what we were created to be, right? We're not as we were created to be. And so we feel guilty for not being what we ought to be. Does that figure? Now, it's in the midst of that that the conscience is working, you see. Law, then, is God's instruction to man in the way of living the true, functional way of life in conformity with creation. So God has put those laws there, as I said, not to be a bugbear to us or a standard to work up to. If I said to you, what are the laws of your body? And we've got a medico or two here this morning. I would say, well, you don't say to yourself, I will breathe. You just breathe, don't you? You know what I mean? You are a conscious being, but it is just functional to breathe, to eat, to hear, to drink, to see, to feel. And because we've gone the malfunctional way of refusing the directive functional law, then we cannot at all accept any form of authority. Now, I can just tell you off the cuff that an alcoholic, a homosexual, a druggie, a promiscuous person sexually, a gambler, compulsive thief, are all persons who have never obeyed anyone. And that goes for chocoholics as much as alcoholics. Work that one through. But, see, if God has given us the law, as he has, then he is the one who has authority over all things. Author is the one who owns what he's authored. God has authored the whole creation, which is, that's why it's called creator. And so the authorities, as Paul tells us in Romans 13, the powers that be, the authorities that be, are ordained of God. If you've got a lousy mum and dad, they nevertheless are God's representatives of his Godhead. And the law and authority are linked. Now, don't start to get worried and think again you're out on a limb if you've been a person who's never obeyed anybody. From the heart, by the way. Towing the line is different from obeying. And don't you think you're sitting here and you're getting all kind of messy inside and saying, well, yes, I'm a person who could never accept anybody. I couldn't accept my parents. I couldn't accept teachers. I can't accept police. I can't accept the government. I can't accept anybody but myself. I have to tell you something. We're all the same. We're all, by birth, we're all rebels. Now, just because we're the same doesn't excuse us. We're all fallen. So we don't like authority any more than anybody else does. At the bottom of the page, the whole question of authority is so vexed that few, if indeed any, can view it objectively. I'm up here, viewing it objectively, of course. Since man rebels against God, he is not going to take kindly to authority. Yet authority, which is genuine authority, is always authority for others' sakes. Now, let's get hold of that. Any authority we're given is for the benefit of others and not for ourselves. The benefit we get is being in the will of God and doing the will of God. But taking authority which doesn't belong to you is dangerous. Or using authority which is given to you to dominate and to extend one's ego is also very dangerous. See, parents are not there just to be the big bosses. They're there to bring up their children to maturity. School teachers are not there to have a grip over children, but to bring them to the maturity of that particular educational system. True? Governments are not there so they can go around and sit in high places and have great meals and everybody think they're it in a bit. What are they there for? They're there to serve the community. Kings were always known as fathers in the old days. And we would like a prime minister who was a father figure, wouldn't we? Well, you think it through. If you hesitate, probably because you wouldn't like a father figure anyway. So just work it through. No criticism, no judgments. Without doubt, the biblical presentation is in hierarchy of authorities. Paul's brief explanation in Romans 13:1-7 is that there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, he who resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. So Paul's conclusion is, therefore, one must be subject not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. It is conscience. Now, we won't go in the next passage. Paul is telling us the reason why we should do certain things and not to certain other things, thus having a free conscience. I've often said that we are free from the domination of sin because we are free from the penalty of sin and the pollution of sin. So we are free when we're freed from condemnation, but we're only freed from condemnation so we may be free to obey. And we're never really free unless we do obey. We know freedom practically in obedience to God. Is that true? But we're never really free until we're free not to do what we're free to do. We are never really free until we are free not to do what we're free to do. Well, perhaps we better look at it. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And Paul says in verse 25, "Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience." Now, you probably know this story in Romans, in 1 Corinthians 10. It goes back to chapter 8 verse, that people that in those days would not eat meat which was offered to idols. Yeah, it was hardly possible to get any meat that was not offered to idols. But if you went and you saw some meat being sold, they just go and buy it and take it home and eat it. And don't ask the guy, was this offered to idols or not? For the sake of conscience. If you ask him then your conscience is going to be put in a certain position. Then he says, "For the earth is the Lord's and everything in it." In other words, that meat is meat, whether people offer to idols or not, so just go and get it and eat it. "If one of the unbelievers invites you to dinner and you're disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience." Now let me tell you, some people have a morbid conscience. They do. They find, they hesitate. I've often told the story of a woman I knew who had a Christian guest house. I don't know what a Christian guest house is, but you know, she's a Christian who had a guest house. And she would say to people, "Have a cup of tea." I don't know that I should. Or people say, "See, you're having sugar in your coffee," and they say, "Ooh, you have sugar. Yeah, you have sugar." Well, what a morbid conscience. Huh? Goes against the grain, I suppose. But if someone says to you, "This has been offered in sacrifice," then out of consideration for the man who informed you and for conscience' sake, I mean his conscience, not yours, don't eat it. Can you pick that up? He says, you could go ahead and eat it. You say, "Meat is meat is meat is meat." And if I eat meat, whatever anybody else has done about it doesn't alter the meat. Well, it's true. But if you get associated, he said, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness of the demons don't own meat because it's offered to them." There's some people, they go into your lounge room and they see an artifact from Bali. Ooh, demons. Well, you know, they turn them out in hundreds of thousands. I don't know where they get a supply of demons for every one of them. It must be incredible. Some people are so dead scared of anything. However, we must be critical. We who are perfect. So, what does Paul mean? That the conscience at this point sees obedience as good, although in fact this may not necessarily be the case, or it may mean that this is God's appointed order and therefore the person is sinning against that. So Paul is surely saying, don't act properly simply because you'll be punished if you don't. Act this way because of the way of truth, the way of God. Now, if somebody couldn't hear what I said on Saturday because I had a artifact from Bali, you know what I do with the artifact from Bali? I would probably use it for fuel in the next fire I made. You know what I mean? Because if I'm not free enough, I'm not really free unless I'm free not to do the things which I'm free to do, or to have the things which I'm free to have. Can you see that? But can you see through all of this that's coming through how sensitive a faculty that conscience is? Boy, it can just leave you in gloom all your life. Some people live under the spirit of legalism all their lives. They're meticulously obeying the law. And you know, if they see a thing out of order in their desk, they've got to straighten it up. That was only a funny little joke. I wasn't really meaning that any harm. All right. Now, if this is so, it raises the whole question of authority. In Romans 13:3, one does what is good. This is similar to God's statement to Cain, "If you do well, shall you not be accepted?" Do you know, good in the Bible means pleasurable, that which gives pleasure. And evil means that which gives pain. That's the old Hebrew words. Right, similarly in 1 Peter 2:18 and 19, one is to obey the authority, even if that same authority be overbearing. See, we are very cunning people. We say, oh yeah, if that man was really worthy of obedience, I'd give it to him. Oh, what a racket. See, he represents God. Now, he may not represent God very well. He may not even have a clue that he represents God. But But he's got a conscience too. And one day he's going to be faced with the wrongness of his... If you're a bad parent, I've not met any bad parents. I've not met many parents who set out to be bad, let me put it that way. Have you? No, very rarely. But if as parents we don't do the right thing by our children, we're going to face that. And that's what the prophet Ezekiel said, that every man shall bear his own sin. The son shall not bear the sin of his father, and the father shall not bear the sin of his son. So you leave the authority to face God for the wrong way in which you use the authority, but you see him as God's representative and go ahead and obey. Unless he comes in conflict with what God has told you very clearly you mustn't do, or you must do. Is that clear? Now, this is all to do with the conscience. Right, this is similar to God's statement to Cain, if you do well, shall you not be accepted? Similarly in Peter, 1 Peter 2:18, one is to obey the authority, even if the authorities be overbearing. Peter says, for one is approved if, mindful of God, he endures pain while suffering unjustly. Now, my dear lady that wrote to me about being angry, what she felt was we were being cheated. We ought to be able to be angry about injustice. But he says, if mindful of God, he endures pain while suffering unjustly. He accepts that. Mindful of God can be translated, this is literally a matter of the text now, for the sake of co-knowledge with God. Mindful of God means for the sake of co-knowledge with God, or for the sake of consciousness of God. In other words, it's a matter of the consciousness of God, which brings you to consciousness of what you should do that you obey. Otherwise you'll be going against your conscience. The Greek term includes the word in synodesis or synedesis. Never mind. Is that right? Synedesis, is that the way you pronounce it? Doesn't matter, does it? Right. Jesus, as we know, was the only man ever to live with a clear conscience. Now, it is interesting that he only ever did what the Father told him. He never did anything apart from what the Father told him. Now, some people call that boring. We are so soaked through with the idea that rebellion brings a joy, in brackets, illicit, that everything that is illicit will give you kicks. Well, it's true. It's true. And that kick will eventually become like one of a mule. It'll give you the kick of the conscience. See, illicit things, like it. Now, I was speaking to a group of young people the other day, and I said that the most powerful producer of guilt is illicit sex. Sex before or outside of marriage gives people an incredible kick, but it's evil. And they looked at me, some of them pityingly. One young woman said to me one day, oh, don't you know, Mr. Bing, there's been a sexual revolution? I said, yeah, I know. 6 months later, she committed suicide. That's the kickback, that you can't beat your conscience. It's incredible what it does to a marriage, anyway, or destroys a marriage. It is interesting that he only ever did what the Father told him. Now, some have never thought that that tranquility and that joy, see, what I delight to do thy will, O Lord, wasn't, I'm a good son to you, O God, I delight to do your will. I've psyched myself up to delight to do your will. He was saying, I get delight from doing your will. True delight, true joy, true tranquility come out of obedience. Right, he paid taxes. He had perfect knowledge of authority. Indeed, it's fruitful to examine his attitude to authority. He paid taxes where they were due. He submitted to a judgment, which in fact was not a true judgment. Far from being revolutionary, he is often depicted to be, he upheld authority. I mean, he told Pilate, I can get legions of angels. There's a funny little thing going on down here, your judgment. And these Jews said, do you think I couldn't whip out of the scene, turn the tables? No, but he was obedient even unto death, the death of the cross. And he let them crucify himself. As Paul said, he was crucified in weakness. So he obeyed. And Paul says, I trained myself to be void of offense before God and man. He was. We take it then that the redeemed conscience will fit itself again to the true created order of the universe, and with the accession of grace will view even bad authorities through the eyes of grace. In any case, conscience must adhere to law and authority. Now, I just Just use a little bit of imagination. We'll suppose that from birth, all of us here has never disobeyed God, which in the sinful world means quite something, because it would all mean that we would never have disobeyed authorities, even though they didn't appeal to us very much. Can you imagine what you'd be like today sitting here? That still sea before the throne of God, that pure sea, there would be no impurity in us, there'd be no raging, be no anger. We wouldn't just be zombies. To the contrary, we would be something that we have never dreamed anyone could be. Now, we've just got 5 minutes before we close the study, so I think what we will do... No, we'll go ahead. Right, page 22. The conscience is rehabilitated. We have seen that man is created and innocent, had a pure conscience. Law to him would have been no heavy matter, conscience being his close awareness of God, and so a functional law flowing from him, would keep the obedient person in peace and harmony. Can you at least understand that in your mind? We have to, don't we? Guilt, however, is what man feels through his conscience. Thus, man cannot truly serve God. The writer of Hebrews has something interesting to say about conscience and its actions. Now, let's turn to Hebrews chapter 1, because what we get out of this book of Hebrews is fantastic. He says, "For the law has but a shadow of the good things to come, instead of the true form of those realities. It can never, by the same sacrifices which are continually offered year after year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered? If the worship had once been cleansed, they would no longer have any consciousness of sin." That's to say, a sinful consciousness, a sinful conscience. "But in these sacrifices, there is a reminder of sin year after year. It is impossible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sin." Now, there's something very powerful in that passage. I was saying that, and you would know it and I would know it, that from the beginning, because man had sinned, the whole principle of sacrifice was created. Sacrifice is a way of a sinful man having union with the Holy God, having fellowship with the Holy God. He offers up something as an admission that he is not worthy to come to God. But God is the author of sacrifice. God gave that to man as a gift. Man didn't work it up. That's not our subject this morning, so I won't go on for the moment. But God gave us sacrifice so that we could have union and fellowship with him. But in Israel, in what we call the Old Covenant, which they call the Covenant, they had this system of sacrifice. When they were guilty, they went to the temple and offered up their sacrifices and came away. It was a very drastic thing, offering a sacrifice, a very bloody thing. And they would come away feeling pure and clean, because since God had given them the system of sacrifice and they'd used it, they could say, "Then I am guiltless." This is a great thing to say, isn't it? But no sooner had they offered up the sacrifice than their sinful beings got into sin again. And sin has a curious way of, present sin has a curious way of linking with past sin. And the whole syndrome, no pun intended, the whole syndrome is back again with all its dynamics of guilt. You know that, don't you? And I know that. So, something else had to happen so there wouldn't be any sinful conscience. Now, fancy spending much of your life, if not most of your life, being conscious of sin and maybe being unconsciously conscious of sin. You know, there's a kind of a shadow over you all the time, and you've got no way of getting out of that. Now, why I was tossing up whether I'd go on with this was to say this, that suppose some of you drop dead during the week. Well, you won't make any difference. I mean, you'll already know one way or the other, won't you? But suppose you don't come back again. Well, that won't really matter. But I'm leaving something suspended this morning. I just don't want to do that. I just want to say it is possible in this world to live without a sense of condemnation and without an unconscious consciousness of sin, and to live with a total consciousness of God. That's why we say there's no condemnation to them that are in Christ Jesus. For somehow what is done on there has broken the power of the law of sin and death, set me free. There's no condemnation. That's incredible, isn't it? But the verse that I suppose, one of the verses anyway, that I love very deeply, richly, is the blood of Christ, which means the death of the cross, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. At this moment, you can live not in original innocence, but you can live as though you had never sinned. Do you see that? You have sinned. That's a fact of life. But to live as though you've never, that's a fantastic thing, isn't it? That's what it is called, justification by grace or justification by faith. We are not under any condemnation. Now, if you want to come back next week and continue the installments, then we'll say how that is so, but I think you all know how it is so. You all know how it is so. I mentioned something about illicit sex. I did that because sometimes you can get to a point of realization much more quickly by going straight at it, and that which is most dynamic. And today, if you were to say that in almost any group of people, you'd either be sneered at, or people get very angry with you, or think you were stupid. And even Christians would think you were. Now, when I was speaking on the cross one night, a young woman said to me after I spoke, she said, "If what you say about the cross is true, then I'm a virgin again." Now that goes for every misdemeanor, every sin, every failure in life. That the cross is of such power and dynamic that it utterly cleanses the conscience. And every one of us here this morning should have an utterly cleansed conscience. If we don't have one, we can ask for it. Cost the cross to do that. And as I say, unless your conscience has a revelation of the cross in all its fullness, all your life you may be a saved Christian person, but all your life you'll still be troubled by guilt. But when your conscience sees that, then your conscience is convinced. And so to speak, it lets you off the hook. But unless your conscience has a revelation of the sin and guilt that he suffered and bore in himself, then your conscience will never let you off the hook. You will always have a consciousness of sin, and you'll always be trying to compensate, either by being good and doing good, you know what I mean? Or obeying authority or bust. Or using the various kinds of tranquilizers, stimulants, I'm not just talking about chemical ones now, that we employ to somehow or another, at least for the moment, give us some kind of release, some kind of peace, some kind of joy. But it's all a gift. What we'll see next week, the pure conscience, the good conscience, the clear conscience, that's dynamic. And remember I said before, I had that little dream of those letters, unread, all sitting in a pile of them, and God saying to me, "They're the love letters I sent to you which you never read." He's not out to grind us into the dust by our conscience or our failure. He's out to do the opposite. Not to let us off the hook in a stupid, senseless way, but in a powerful and a suffering way through the cross and his resurrection. Let's pray.